So a guy walks by the dry cleaner store, and he sees a sign, and it says, "My name is Fink, and what do you think? I wash clothes for free." So he thinks, great. Must be like some kind of special promotion. And he goes in and he drops off all of his dry cleaning. And he comes back a few days later. The guy says, that'll be $40. He says, what do you mean $40? Look at the sign. It says it very clearly. My name is Fink, and what do you think? I wash clothes for free. And the guy says, you don't know how to read. What it says is, my name is Fink, and what do you think? I wash clothes for free. I thought of this when I proposed the title for today's sermon. Some of you may know we send out by email on Thursday what the sermon title is going to be, which means that I have to think of one earlier in the week. And this week's sermon title was, Who Do You Think You Are? And a couple of people wrote me back and they said, you know, this can be taken a few ways. It could be, so what's your self-conception? Or it could be like, so who do you think you are? As though, what do you think, I wash clothes for free? Because that is often what people say when you say, give me some of that. Who do you think you are? You don't get that. And this playing with words is very appropriate today, because today, you may or may not know, is Bloomsday. That is, 110 years ago, James Joyce set his novel in June 14th in Dublin, Ulysses, which became the most famous novel of the 20th century, and Joyce to many, the most accomplished writer of the 20th century. In fact, three writers are usually named, if you had to take a poll, as the greatest writers of the 20th century: Franz Kafka, Marcel Proust, and James Joyce. Kafka and Proust were both Jewish. I'm just saying. They just were. It's just true. Two out of three. And Joyce, who was Irish, made the main character of his most famous novel, Ulysses, Leopold Bloom, who is Jewish. So I think we get 2.5, actually. But what was interesting about Joyce's novel is not only that he plays with words more than almost any writer who ever lived, with the exception of Shakespeare, but also that his book, when it came out, would not be published in the United States because it was brought up on charges of obscenity. Believe me, what Joyce wrote would be nothing today, but at the time, it caused a huge controversy. And because he played so much with words, people weren't sure quite how obscene he was really being. But finally, it came to court in the United States, and it was permitted in because the judge decided, and you'll see why this is relevant in a moment, that the obscenity was incidental to the purpose of the story. That is, Joyce didn't write a book in order to be obscene, but rather wrote a book to say many things, and the obscenity was a part of the way that he felt he needed to say it. I bring this up, first because of words, and second because of obscenity. Because I don't want to get in trouble when I quote the Torah. And I'm about to quote the Torah, so don't blame me. This Haftarah this morning, I remember vividly because it was the only thing when I was a kid in yeshiva that my teacher skipped. So all of us went home and read for the only time, completely unprompted, the Torah that we didn't read in class. It's about when the spies go into the land the second time in the time of Joshua, and they stay at the home of Rahab the Zonah. Now, Rahab is easy. It's the second word that's not so easy. Zonah, the rabbis say, because they don't want to say the actual meaning of the word Zonah, comes from mazon, which means food, so she was really an innkeeper. But those of you who know Hebrew know that even in modern Hebrew, zonah does not mean innkeeper, except in the broadest sense of the word. She did entertain people in her home, but she was not an innkeeper. That's all I'm going to say about that. As we say in Hebrew, hamevin yavin, that is, those who understand will understand. Those who don't, probably shouldn't. But that's an extraordinary thing if you think about it. Because the Torah portrays this woman, a woman of what is called in Old English, a woman of ill repute. They portray her as the people, as the person who encourages and saves the spies and enables them to look at the land. And so it goes back to the question, who do you think you are? The Greeks used to say that character is fate. Who you are determines what happens to you. And that idea is certainly woven through the Jewish tradition and woven through the Torah. That is, all of Judaism is supposed to be a training in growing your soul, in trying to help you be who you are. But it begins in part with your self-conception. That is, most of the Torah criticizes the Israelites. It tells them all the things they do wrong. But it doesn't start that way. It starts with a human being is in the image of God. It starts the Jewish people with, you will be a blessing. In other words, once you know that your destiny is to be great, then you can be told all the things that you do wrong. But first, who you think you are must be something beautiful, something in the image of God, something noble, something holy, and then you can switch the question to, just who do you think you are? It's almost like the way we use the word human. When someone treats you badly, you say, hey, I'm a human being. When you do something wrong, you go, look, I'm only human. And they're both true. That's why, as I've told you before, the Hasidic rabbi Abraham Tversky used to say that when his father wanted to criticize him, he wouldn't say to him, you were bad. And he wouldn't even say to him, what you did was bad. He would say, Avram, what you did is not worthy of you. Which is a way of saying simultaneously, you did something that you ought not to have done, but only because you are better than that. So when we see the spies go in the land with Caleb and Yehoshua the first time now, when we see the spies go in the land, that's exactly the drama that is playing out. That is, are these people worthy? Are they, in their own minds, something important and something noble? Obviously, for 10 of them, no. 10 of them have been so beaten down by the experience of slavery that they don't think that they could get or deserve the land that God has promised. But the other two, by some miracle of resistance, still have exalted conceptions of themselves and of the Jewish people. This has played out throughout our history. You and I both know that Jews, on the whole, have a tendency to think rather well of ourselves. And sometimes we make fun of that, and sometimes we criticize that. But you realize we could never have lived through thousands of years of the world telling us how terrible we were if we didn't believe that we were better than what everyone was saying. When everybody was saying, who do you think you are? We had to say inside of ourselves, we know who we are. That sense of what we call today self-esteem, but what I would say is about a knowledge of your soul and a belief that God made you important and holy, that sense was crucial if we were going to survive all of the difficulties, the pains, the persecutions, the massacres, the cruelties of the world. But the Jewish experience should also influence our personal experience. That is, if you're going to survive in the world, then you have to know both that you are important, that your soul reflects something of the image of the divine, and that therefore you have something to live up to inside yourself. It doesn't mean that because you think well of yourself, you never do anything wrong, or you never do anything bad, or you don't get upset with yourself, or you can't be criticized, or everything you do is great. That is the opposite of a healthy soul. It means rather that you understand what Kalev and Yehoshua did. Who you are, where you come from, what your destiny is, and what you deserve. That's a powerful and important teaching. And it didn't originate with modern psychology. The first person who decided, or the first idea that you had to be important and recognize that you were important was not on Oprah, it was in Bereshit. Because the first thing Rabbi Akiva tells us that human beings know is not just that we are loved, but it's with a special love that God let us know we are loved. That's the foundation. And that's why God had to march the Israelites through the desert for 40 more years until they knew that they were important, that they were loved, that the land could be theirs. So earlier, those of you who were here heard Rabbi Guzik talk about why it is that Hosea's name was changed before he went into the land to Yehoshua. And she reminded us that the addition was the addition of a Yud, which represents God. In other words, Yehoshua knew that he was in God's image. That's why he could walk into the land and know that it could be his. And by the way, the rabbis tell us something very lovely. Where did they come up with that Yud to give to Yehoshua? The answer is, if you remember, Sarai's name was changed to Sarah, just as Abram was changed to Abraham. Well, once Sarai became Sarah and she got a hay, which also represents God, God was left with an extra Yud. So he looked around and he saw Hosea and he knew he had to be Yehoshua. So Yehoshua got Sarai's Yud. Which tells you something important. That is, the idea that you're in the image of God is transferable. It can go from parent to child. Tomorrow's Father's Day. Parents can give their children that esteem, that certainty, that promise that lets them know that their souls matter and that they can do beautiful and wonderful things in this world. And that doesn't mean that everything they do is great, or everything they do is right, or every ashtray they bring home from preschool is a masterpiece. My mother used to have like 20 ashtrays lined up, because it was all we could make. But it does mean, that you see inside of yourself and others this infinite potential. This possibility, that you see yourself the way Kalev and Yehoshua do. Remember what the other spies came back and said. They said, we looked like grasshoppers to them. Like we were less than human. And that's when God knew that the Israelites weren't ready. When God comes to speak to Yehezkel, to Ezekiel, in the second chapter of the book, he says, Amod al raglecha va'adaber lech. Stand on your own two feet, and then I will speak to you. In other words, for a human being to be in God's image means for them to have pride and self-assertion and promise and to know it. And to know it. It is not a coincidence that in the Jewish prayer service, when you bow, You bow at Baruch and at Atah, but when you say God's name, when you say Adonai, you stand upright. That's how we come before God in our tradition. Standing upright, because we are in God's image, which means not just that we are sacred, but that we can do almost anything together and many things individually that you might not believe are possible. I know that because what it is that the spies wanted to do thousands of years ago is true today. That is, the land that people believed we could never have, we have. The accomplishments that Jews could never achieve, we have achieved. So let's take our model from Yehoshua, from Caleb, and even from Rahab. Once she had a different conception of herself, her life changed. And she became a Zonah who helped save the Jewish people. So imagine what we can do. Imagine what you can do. If you really do believe that you're in God's image, and therefore, anything is possible. Shabbat Shalom.